Real Life, the program that talks about the life of real estate in the Hamptons and the North Fork. The people, the places, and the things that are the pulse and heartbeat of life on the East End. And now, Associate Broker of Sotheby's International Realty, your host, John Christopher.
Welcome back to Real Life, and today as my guest, I have Dr. Andrew Pepper, who is a veterinarian. Hi, Andrew. How are you today?
I'm doing well, John. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. The last time you were on, we got into a little controversy, talking about some controversial subjects. But today, I just want to do something very straightforward. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Nassau County in Long Island, and we moved out here about 20 years ago. And as you know, it's a special place, this East End we live in.
How did you get here? I mean, how did you get from Nassau County? I mean, it's not that far.
I started working for Dr. Turetsky over at Good Friend Park, and I was commuting. Having grown up in Nassau, I loved Long Island, but it was very congested, and so I think this is sort of a perfect
living environment. You don't think we're congested here in the summertime?
It's very brief, and the problem out here in the summer is that, a couple of hundred people make the villages seem pretty congested.
That's true.
We're really dealing with, a couple of thousand extra people, and the seasonality of this place is wonderful. The fact that it gets busy in the summer and it's predictable, and then the winter rolls around and that's predictable.
Do you find that your business increases during the summer because of the people coming?
Most definitely, yeah. It goes up 30-40%.
And it's great what you do because you go to the client, right?
That's right. I go to people's houses, and the idea is to try to keep the stress level down for the animals. People love it, and the animals seem to do much better. They don't really hate me much.
Who, the animals or the people?
The animals. They don't seem to. When you bring a dog into a clinic, there's a smell. I think they pick up on a fear, and they start shaking even before they get through the door. And with a cat, to bring a cat in, you got to put in a carrier, you got to take it in a car. By the time they actually get into the office,
they're a little stressed, right?
They're quite frightened, and rightfully so. So my thing is to try to make it so that it's not a stress, and they don't mind me so much.
Right.
People often ask me, "Do you have a trailer? Do you, go around and have a trailer?" And I always feel that I'd rather look at the animals in their house and their environment, not take them into a trailer, because that would be the same effect as, like a hospital.
But do you find that you sometimes, by going into the environment where the animal resides, is a good indication, gives you a better perspective on the health and
Most definitely.
The well-being
of
the animal?
You see things that you would never see in an office. You see that the food dishes is totally filled three times the amount of food that an animal should have. Or you see that they're living with problems, urination in the house or other issues that, you pick up on right away that maybe they would never bring up in an office setting because they don't think it's a problem. They don't, they don't think this is an issue that I need help with.
Right. And you see that right away and you can give recommendations and help.
Within minutes, you sort of know what people are living with.
Did you have any mentors when you were growing up?
My father, who taught me to work hard, and different doctors at school that were, but no one person, though.
Oh. So did you follow that axiom of working hard?
Oh, yeah.
I think you work hard. I'm just being facetious here with you, that's all. Now, what happens if an animal needs an operation? What do you do then?
Well, it depends if it's an elective procedure or it's more of an emergency type of situation. I do rent space at one of the hospitals out here, and I take it over and do procedures one day a month so I can do spays and neuters, simple operations that are day procedures. If it's anything more complicated or it needs to get done ASAP, I try to refer you into any of the vet hospitals that are here.
Yeah.
There's four or five different hospitals out here. They're all very good. I have a different niche, and I try to stick to that niche, and I try to explain to people surgery is not so much part of that niche. Mm. I don't want to cut them open in your house.
Right. I don't think so. Okay. It's not like the olden times. Right?
People would ask. I mean, sometimes I believe people would ask you to do things that, you know, when I started, I kind of had the idea that, well, if somebody wants me to do something, I'll give it a whirl, you know. And then quickly you realize that that's not such a good idea. You're the professional. You got to be the one in charge. And you have to, and it's hard to tell people, okay, I know you called me because you want to try to keep everything in the house, but now this is something that you need to get into a hospital to work on.
And a more sterile environment.
Sterile, yeah. And with all the equipment that they have. Yeah. And again, when you start cutting things open, you want to be in a hospital.
Now, we have a lot of horse farms out here. Do you have any horse patients?
I don't treat horses, no. I leave that to the horse specialists. And I did grow up with horses, and I used to ride when I was a kid, but that was a long time ago. And the way vet medicine is you really do want a specialist. If you have a horse, you want somebody who does horses.
That's all they do is horses.
Horses, if you know, and the same thing with the dog. I think it's not to have a horse vet come and look at your dog or cat, I'm not sure is really going to do you justice.
So have you ever had any exotic animals that you had to take care of?
Oh, sure.
Like snakes or wild birds?
Snakes and reptiles and birds. And I think the most exotic thing was Amy the armadillo, which...
An armadillo?
Yes, this was
I didn't even know you could have a pet armadillo.
Well, it was at the museum in Pittsfield, Massachusetts when I worked up there, and Amy got sick, and I had to call an armadillo specialist in Texas, and he told me they all have leprosy, and leprosy is a big problem in armadillos, and right. I tried to assure him that Amy had been in this museum for 20 years, and I didn't think that
she
was the issue with Amy, but...
leprosy.
I think it was renal failure, and eventually died, and it was kind of sad. And they had a big thing on the front page of the paper that Amy died at our vet clinic.
And that's when you had to leave Pittsfield and come.
That's when I had to get out of there because after losing it on the.
Are there any challenges being a mobile vet?
It's unique. I mean, I find one of the hardest things is having the animal present when I get there, that they haven't wandered off somewhere. A lot of times people don't lock them up, and they don't, cats in particular, if they hear my car or even, you know, get a whiff of me, they're gone. So, you know, the idea that I come to the house doesn't necessarily mean you can't take some, you have to lock them up. You have to make sure that they're going to be there when I get there.
So what are some of the benefits,
The benefits is I get to enjoy the East End. I mean, I get to stop for lunch on the side of the road and eat my sandwich and see the most beautiful places that are out there. And the other benefits is, you know, because I can sign and set my day the way I want. And I get to do nice things for people all the time.
So life is good.
Life for me is good doing this.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah. How can someone get in contact with you?
My number is 725-0815.
What is that again?
725-0815. And there's a machine at the other end that will take your messages 24/7, 7 days a week. And I do return all calls.
Great.
7 days a week.
Dr. Andrew Pepper, it's been a delight having you on the program. And this is John Christopher. And we'll be right back with Dr. Sydney Baker, physician and founder of Autism 360. Welcome back to Real Life, and this is John Christopher, your host, and today I have as my guest Dr. Sydney Baker, who is a physician and founder of Autism 360. Hi, Sid. How are you today?
Hi, John.
Glad to have you on. Before we talk about alternative medicine and the Autism 360 Foundation, can you tell us how you ended up in Sag Harbor after practicing medicine basically all around the world?
Well, I... became engaged to a lovely and wise psychoanalyst whose roots were in Sag Harbor. So that was it. I told her in the early part of our courtship I wouldn't leave Connecticut except feet first. But we came to Sag Harbor, and I looked around for 15 seconds, and I said, this will do just fine. So here we are.
Well, you do have. I know your home, and you do have a lovely house. Now we're seeing a shift, and it seems to me it's a slow shift in the medical profession to alternative forms of healing rather than relying on the pharmaceutical industry to cure chronic diseases. What led you to follow this path of alternative medicine?
I was branded before I went to medical school.
What do you mean by that?
I was working with a Dr. Edgar Miller in Kathmandu, Nepal, in a year that I took off thanks to a gift from my deceased father's Exeter roommate. I took a year off from Yale. Before I went through the tunnel of medical school, I thought I should see the watery part of the world, and I ended up in Kathmandu, not very close to the water, with a wonderful doctor who, for 3 months, took me with him to little clinics around the valley of Kathmandu, and after each patient, he would turn to me and say, "Sydney, have we done everything we can for this patient? This patient." When I went to medical school a couple of years later at Yale, the question was, have we done everything we can for this disease? But I was already stuck on understanding that the focus of treatment is the individual, not the disease. Now, I got through medical school okay, but I was still stuck with the fundamental principle that the patient is the target of therapy.
Now, do you think that's going to change, or is there an evolution to that thinking? I hear you taking a deep breath.
Well, I'm taking a deep breath because it's changing slowly, yes. I crossed the line in the early 1970s, and when I became a full-time practitioner, a family doctor. And once I stepped over that line, I realized that my loneliness was not going to be soon cured. has been a slow process, but I would say that overall, given the reluctance of many large enterprises such as the practice of medicine and so on to go through fundamental changes in the way they think, it's moving along pretty quickly. I think partly because, as we'll talk about, the public is behind this and armed with what we call common sense.
Right. It does seem like common sense, what you're doing. One of the things I know, it's been called different other alternative medicine, integrative, functional, holistic medicine, but it's often misunderstood. And do you have any ideas or thoughts as to why that is?
Well, in the 1870s and 80s, there weren't many normal people in Dodge City, right? They were what we call outliers. They were out there.
Right.
Some of them were misfits, and some of them were very well suited to the new landscape of the Far West and the frontier. But a lot of them were pretty quirky people. In the 1970s and 80s, no migration took place, but the medical landscape had changed under our feet from one focused on acute illness, where the metaphors of medicine work very well, to chronic illness, where they don't work well. And doctors responding to that change by exploring new territory were, again, outliers themselves. To step outside of the medical mainstream requires a pretty good stepper.
Right, right.
And some of them were quirky people, and hippies and doctors who were easily sneered at by their colleagues. In other words, others were very bright and connected well with science. And in that effort to find the ground and identify what it was all about, naturally, there were some experiments that didn't work out very well, and others, people were not able to articulate very well what they were doing as alternative or functional or so on. So I think the landscape takes some blame, the pioneers take some blame, and of course I think mainstream medicine takes blame for being amazingly inflexible.
Right, right. You founded Autism 360. What is that exactly?
Autism 360 is a private, not-for-profit, anonymous website serving the needs of the autism spectrum community. It's based on an invention that I created beginning in 1969 when I was assistant professor of medical computer sciences at Yale. And my mentor said to me that when medical people and IT people get together, they're going to automate the past. And he was right.
Right.
And but he also said, if you're going to get medical information into useful ways, you should have it in rows and columns.
Hmm.
Okay, so I started a 20-year project of trying to encode the granular details of people's medical narrative into rows and columns. See a big spreadsheet, but spreadsheet that has more than two dimensions. And based on this, the Moody's Foundation offered to fund a slice out of this pie to serve the interests of the autism community, with a chance for people to describe the details of their child's problems in ways that allowed matching with other children, and then a revelation on the website in real time of actionable options based on those details and the response of other children in that cluster to treatment. So in other words, it's not based on the label, it's based on individuality again. And
so you're saying a lot of people think autism is a generic kind of word that covers certain symptoms, but what you're saying is that each person or child, whoever has autism, is different. It's a different way of responding to it, and as the practitioner, that's how you respond to it too, I imagine.
Yeah, speaking of landscapes in medicine, the landscape, of course, goes over both space and time. And the beginning of the autism landscape began around 1942, and the word was coined around children who couldn't talk, couldn't behave, and were weird in lots of ways. And had lots of funny movements and behaviors, couldn't relate, so on. And so then this label began applied to children who had these kinds of difficulties.
You know what I'm going to do, Sid? I'm going to have you come back again. We're running out of time right now. In the meantime, how could someone get in contact with you or to maybe perhaps donate to the Autism 360?
Well, go on our website, which is autism360.org. And it's, as I say, it's a free service to our users who are the parents of children and autistic adults who are looking for answers.
Great. Okay. Sid, it's been a pleasure having you on the program. This is John Christopher, and we'll be right back with my next guest, director of Da Vinci House, Puneet Chuk. Welcome back to Real Life, and this is John Christopher, your host. Today we have with us Puneet Chuk, who is the director of Da Vinci House. Puneet, it's so wonderful to have you. How are you doing today, by the way?
Thank you, John. It's wonderful. Great day.
Good. It is a great day. You have a revolutionary building design that's called Da Vinci House, and that's why I want you to come on, because it's so unique, I thought. But your background is as an architect. So give us the background to how you became involved with Da Vinci House.
Well, John, I've been in this space for about 26 years. And as an architect, when I started working, I was always looking for a better system that would actually create a complete offering for a client. It's just been a discovery of understanding people's pain points and seeing where we can offer the best value. As the markets are changing, more technology is being introduced in homes. Obviously, we also want to make sure that the homes are built with the latest materials, the ones that last. And Da Vinci House turned out to be a great value for us when we partnered with them. Strangely, this company has almost a track record of 100% client satisfaction, which turns out to be one of the greatest value attributes if someone is looking to partner with them. So we have partnered with Da Vinci House Germany with a track record of over 3,000 homes built. And after three and a half years of developing this model for the local U.S. market, we are in a big way and want to make sure everybody understands about Da Vinci House and comes and speaks to us to learn more about it, to at least understand the options available to them.
Wonderful. That is really great. I've seen some, you know, I've been to, you have a sample house, right, that's on your, where your office is. Where is your office located?
Well, our office is on the Main Street, Bridgehampton, on 27. It's the little white building. The address is 2272 Montauk Highway. So I don't think you can miss it. As soon as you pass the traffic light, past Butter Lane, we are the second building to the left.
Okay. So now when they come to see the sample, some of the things you can show them is it's like the walls are has the insulation. The windows were phenomenal. I've seen the sliders that it surpass, forget Anderson, but they surpass what are some of the Marvin and some of the higher end windows. And you incorporate all that.
Absolutely. We are a complete building system. So rather than looking at materials as such, we really built that studio or that little space to let people experience the true quality. I think quality is something that people need to experience. We can't talk enough about it. When we talk about the windows or the insulation, we're not talking about these materials individually, because I'm sure people can pick these pieces individually and try to incorporate them in their own homes or their designs. But what is the driver is how do you maximize the home and its performances by putting these materials together? So it's a sum total of what we put together on DaVinci, which is this unique DaVinci system. We are building passive homes, and that really means that these homes are optimally designed. Your quality of the inner space is amazing. You're living in a very good home. You're breathing better air. Your mechanical systems are undersized. So really you're being environmentally sensitive in how you use the global footprint. So in terms of coming to the design studio, it was our intention to first show to people that we can deliver these homes very successfully. We tried it at our own location amidst all the challenges and everything that we had to overcome. We have shown that we can deliver, and we can always take it forward from there. So that's a great place for people to stop and understand all the pieces that come together. And lastly, I would say, in terms of the quality, I can assertively say that at this point in time, we have the best home building technology in this entire country, leave alone particular windows or a roof package or the wall package. As an integrative whole, nobody can beat us in this market at this
right.
point.
Yeah, I believe you on that. One of the things that was kind of interesting is when you take the tour of the model, is the once you close that slider, it's like soundproof. It's you don't hear the noise, and that's because of the way they build the windows.
The windows and the walls total, and that's why we really have. I think the location of the studio or the building really worked out in a way. Even though it turned out to be a natural selection on that site that optimized the location, but it turned out to be so good for us because that's one of the elements that people would want to consider when they're inside their house. It's their peaceful time, and you really don't want, especially if you're considering properties and you have traffic going through, you really want to say, okay, when I'm inside, I want to enjoy my inside of the space, and when you're outside, it's a different experience. So to kind of come and look at that, I think the glass definitely does a lot of the magic, but I don't believe that the glass itself can really do that. So I think the whole building system itself is that we have about 80 years of legacy of building these homes. There is a continuous innovation process in place. So at every point in time, we're looking to surpass and set the benchmarks in the market rather than be a follower. We want to actually be the leader creating something rather than just competing in a space.
One of the things I found interesting, too, is that you can, somebody comes in and says, geez, I love this whole concept. I've got a piece of land. How long would it take to build after you've designed a house for them? How long would it take? And you can give them a date, correct?
We can. We definitely gravitate more towards giving them a finish date on the construction project itself. As you might realize, and so with the clients out here, is that each building permit process could be different depending on the location of the site and what it has to go through. So typically we do have the expertise and the know-how of what the site would require. We definitely be we work as a catalyst and work side by side with the client to make sure that the process is facilitated and the submissions are complete. But having said that, the permitting process takes its own course because it is statutory.
Yeah.
Once the permitting process is done, we can give them a firm delivery date, which is what we live and die by.
Here's another thing that I like, because I've worked with architects in the past, is that, and they'll put on a contingency fee. In other words, on the pricing, they'll say, okay, this house, but we have... It could go over like 10%. It could go over to 15%. But you can say, okay, this house will cost X amount of dollars, and there won't be a cent above that.
Absolutely. That's one of the greatest attribute that we come down. With our building process, we have removed the uncertainty out of the equation for our client. We basically are promising a fixed delivery time of 32 weeks start to finish on a project. We are talking about a fixed cost on the onset, so the clients are not exposed to any more in terms of the dollar value. We are talking about a total quality management that is sitting at the highest benchmark possible. We are talking about an integrative singular point accountability and a process that really stands for itself, where we make sure that the building process is made as stress-free as can be, because we want people to enjoy the process. People talk about an enjoyable process, but we live by that. We want to make sure that when the clients come in, there's a single point accountability, so the fragmentation of these processes are taken out from our building systems.
That's wonderful. Puneet, how can somebody get in touch with you?
Well, I'm just a phone call away.
Good.
People can always reach out to our office. And also, there is an email address, which is hello@davincihouse.com. And either me or one of our team members will be very happy to talk to a client and understand what their project needs are, and also help walk them through the whole Da Vinci proposition.
That's wonderful. This is John Christopher for Real Life on Peconic Public Broadcasting, 88.3, right here in Southampton, New York. By the way, if you're interested in hearing this program again or previous ones, you can go to peconicpublicbroadcasting.org and subscribe to the podcast. Until next time, looking forward to seeing you soon, and have a safe journey.
You've been listening to Real Life, the program that talks to the people about the places and things that are the pulse and heartbeat of real estate on the East End. Your host has been John Christopher, associate broker with Sotheby's International Realty. Your producer and engineer is Kyle Lynch. Theme music by John Christopher. Questions and comments can be emailed to john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com.